Let's see. That doesn't look right. What's the, Oh, there it is. Okay. Okay, great. Good morning. Boker Tov, as the Hebrew is. Dobro Utra, Dobro Ranak, the whole litany. So today we are talking about two things, divine institutions and post-fascism. In the first hour, we'd like to discuss divine institutions, what they are, how we derive them biblically. In short, the Bible has given us a description of how God has designed the world, and he has designed the world such that we are parts of certain social structures by default. And if we uphold that which the Bible says we should uphold, it will help us to identify certain erroneous political theories. Of them include leftism and wokeism and Rushism, which we'll discuss in the later hour. So first let's talk about divine institutions. In this section we'll talk about how worldviews work. We'll look at some alternative models to divine institutions, and then we'll develop a biblical model. So first things first, a definition. Divine institutions are social structures for the benefit of humanity, of which God designed all people to be members by default. The divine institutions are the individual, the family, and the country. So this is what we are describing here. Before we jump too far into that, let's take a step back and look at the big picture of how worldviews work. A worldview can be described as having at least these four components: epistemology, metaphysics, ethics, and sociopolitical philosophy. Metaphysics describes the layout of the universe. It deals with ontology, the nature of being, teleology, axiology, questions of design and value, eschatology, the theories about the future. Is the sun going to blow up one day and consume us all, or is the Messiah going to establish a messianic kingdom here on earth? Epistemology deals with the question of knowledge. How do we know what we know? How can we remember things? What is our authority? Is it scripture, or do we just observe things around us? Then we have ethics, which deals with what's right, what's wrong, and social-political philosophy, how to run a society. Now, these bottom two disciplines, metaphysics and epistemology, they describe the way the things are, whereas the top two, ethics and social-political philosophy, tell us the way things ought to be. Now, the logical procession would be to build your worldview from the bottom up, starting with the way things are and then developing the way things ought to be. The unfortunate tendency in society is the other way around. We start at the level of politics and whom to vote for and what policy to support, and then we decide based off of that whether or not it's right or wrong to do this sort of behavior, that behavior, and then eventually our metaphysics and epistemology will catch up from there. That's the way that society pressures us toward. I would encourage us, though, to start with the bottom up, with a biblical epistemology, which accepts the word of God as being our authority. All right, so that's a crash course on how worldviews work. Let's look at some alternative models that have developed throughout the history of the church for the past 2,000 years. We're dealing with the question of socio-political thought, and this is something that's been dealt with from the earliest days of church history. We see it in the writings of Justin Martyr and Tertullian, who wrote before Christianity became legal. Lactantius was probably the last one before Christianity became more accepted. He wrote a very exhaustive explanation of Christianity. He made a lot of mistakes. But he's actually the first one to probably use the term divine institutions in Latin. And he used it for a completely different thing. Eventually, Christianity became legalized, and the Roman Catholic Church began what's called a two-sword doctrine, which saw the church over the state, hence the crowning of Charlemagne by Pope Leo III, right? The Pope is in charge. He chooses who gets to be the emperor underneath them. This very quickly turns into corruption, though, hence the need for the Reformation. Meanwhile, in the Eastern Orthodox Church, we have the system that they call symphonia, in which they see the church and the state working together, side by side. This is also prone to corruption. We're currently seeing a lot of this in Russia as we speak. Eventually, we get to the time of the Reformers. And the Reformers, such as Jean Calvin and Jan Łaski in Poland, developed a more freedom-driven sociopolitical thought, being as how they were oppressed by the Roman Catholic Church. They started moving toward a separation of church and state. Move forward a couple hundred years, and we get into the 19th and 20th centuries. Abraham Kuyper is one who followed in their footsteps. Now, Abraham Kuyper was raised Dutch Reformed, but he's kind of like your modern typical raised in the conservative Christianity and then deconstruction kind of guy. Went to college and was a full-blown heretic, Unitarian, and all this, rejecting Christianity entirely. But he wrote his dissertation on John Calvin and Jan Łaski. Eventually, he abandoned the modernist movement and became Orthodox Reformed, but he never really got a good grounding in conservative biblicism. He joined the Dutch anti-revolutionary movement, which was just reactionary. He never really had a robust biblical theology. He was Reformed, but even from a Reformed perspective, he wasn't a biblicist. His big contribution was an idea that he called sphere sovereignty. He identified several spheres in the world: industry, family, art, church, science. And he said each of these should be separate from each other, following down that Reformed line of thought. The difficulty is, where does this come from? What's the epistemology that's based on? Can anyone open the Bible, please, to the page that talks about the sovereign sphere of the media? It's not in there, right? He was just observing the world around him. And we're seeing a lot of Reformed theologians to this day kind of trying to follow in those steps. One of the weaknesses in his view was that it was adopted for very differing purposes. The South African country had been through some turmoil at the time. There was a lot of Dutch Reformed influence down there. And they took the idea of apartness from Kuyper's thinking. They also considered some of the more racist, racially driven statements that he made. And they derived a apartness political philosophy, which apartness in Afrikaans language. Does anyone know Afrikaans enough to guess what apartness would be? Apartheid, right? Being a cognate. So Kuyper wasn't the father of apartheid, but he was the grandfather. Others have used his ideology to promote black liberation theology, which is also a very erroneous system of theology, but because the sphere sovereignty model is not robust biblically, there was no real constraints to keep it from going weird in that direction or weird in this one. Throughout the 20th century, we see the rise of post-millennialism. We have guys like R.J. Rushdoony on the left here. As he became increasingly disenfranchised with evangelicalism, he went further and further down the post-millennial framework, saying that we need to completely overthrow the government, revise the Mosaic Law, and put it into place here in the States. In his vision, he said that we should get to a point where we are executing anyone who practices Hinduism, for example. This should be deeply concerning. And it's on the rise again. I'm seeing a lot of weird stuff on the social media. It's gotten to the point now whenever I see a young evangelical on social media, whom I've never met before, espouting anti-Semitism, I can just cut to the chase and say, you weren't post-millennial a decade ago. Why are you now? And it's usually some story about, oh, well, I was a dispensationalist and they never really taught me. So there's a lot of post-millennial reactionism going on today. Paula White here on the left is another figure from the post-millennialist movement. She's Donald Trump's spiritual advisor. She is a proponent of the Seven Mountain Mandate, which began in 1975 with a purported message from God delivered to Lauren Cunningham, Bill Bright, and Francis Schaeffer. If you hold to the sufficiency and completion of scriptures, that should be automatically suspicious that we've got a new revelation coming in 1975. But their thing is they have seven spheres: family, religion, education, media, entertainment, business, and government, which they're trying to conquer. Okay, so we just looked over about 2,000 years of socio-political thought within Christianity. What is a common basis that we're seeing for all of these? A frequent thing that we're seeing from the two-sword doctrine all the way to the Seven Mountain Mandate is an inaugurated eschatology that says the kingdom that was promised in the Old Testament, that's not a real thing. In reality, there's a spirit kingdom that's here and now, and we grow the kingdom through enforcing it through the government. Of course, the Bible has no instructions for how to grow the kingdom because the kingdom is not now and we're not here to grow it. The kingdom will be established by the Messiah later. But because there isn't any instructions for that, it's an opportunity for theologians to insert whatever particularly weird agenda they happen to have, be it political or otherwise. That would be the metaphysical basis. Let's go another level deeper, though. What is the epistemology that their inaugurated eschatology is coming from? Well, several things, right? In the case of Kuyper, it's just observing the world around him. Often it's influenced by money and political backing financially. It's through various works. It's anything and everything but the Bible, basically. So I propose that we develop a different way to approach the topic of social political thought. Rather than doing a top-down approach, what if we start at the bottom? And what if our epistemology begins by recognizing the Bible as our authority? What if we start by accepting that the Bible is sufficient to inform us on these matters and stick to what the Bible says as our primary source for information on this topic? If we do that, then we're going to have a metaphysics that I think will reveal these three divine institutions that we've already mentioned, the individual, the family, and the country. And if we start with a biblical approach to these three, then we can start to develop an ethics and a socio-political philosophy, or as a bare minimum, at least identify some problematic socio-political philosophies and ethical systems in light of the scriptures. I think that the Bible gives us a lot more freedom than sometimes we want it to, and that's okay. But I think that if we recognize that God values these three things, then there are certain things that we should not be doing in the socio-political realm. All right, so we looked at how world wars work. We've considered some alternative models that have come out of Christendom for 2,000 years. Now, let's take a look at the divine institution model. Quick question. Has anyone heard the term divine institutions before? Okay. It's a term that several of my favorite thinkers in the 20th century were using to describe more than just three things. You'll often hear responsible labor, marriage, family, maybe civil government, distinct nations. That's okay. If you're listening to a speaker that has more than three, that's okay. My little contribution to the discussion is that I've identified three things that are multifaceted, so that would combine a couple of divine institutions and other models, and I'm restricting it to what we are part of by default. Israel and the church are institutions, and they are divine in origin, and they are for the benefit of humanity, so we could argue that those are also divine institutions. But for the purposes here, we're talking about what we are part of by default. You're not born a husband, for example. You may or may not be born a Jew. Okay, so the three divine institutions, the individual, the family, and the country. Let's return to the definition one more time. Divine institutions are social structures for the benefit of humanity, of which God designed all people to be members by default. The divine institutions are the individual, the family, and the country. So let's take these one at a time. First is the individual. Now, in systematic theology, right, we have different types of theology. There's biblical theology, the study of portions of Scripture. We have dogmatic theology, the study of different schools of thought. We have historical theology, the study of how doctrine developed. Systematic theology is the study of theology by categories of doctrine. There's about a dozen. One category of theology that's really big in Christian theology is the doctrine of anthropology, which is the doctrine of man. What is a man? What's he made out of? And so forth. So the doctrine of anthropology is quite informative as a systematic category of theology. It is informative to the divine institution of the individual. It helps us to understand our worldview. If we develop our anthropology on a biblical epistemology, I think we can read through that lens and derive a couple of points in ethics and metaphysics. Two big points I'd like to talk about here are meta-ethics, which deals with the basis of ethics. We're living in interesting times where the philosophy discussion has turned to a lot of meta prefixes, meta dealing with beforehand, right? So what is our basis for ethics, meta-ethics? I think we can derive a meta-ethics of responsible labor. We'll take a look at what that means. As far as metaphysics, we can describe ontology, which is the doctrine of being, the philosophy of being, specifically with regard to the facets of man, which is something that if you pick up your average systematic theology textbook, it will talk about. All right, so let's talk about ontology, the facets of man. Man is typically considered to be two basic chunks, right? There's the material, and then there's the immaterial facets of man. Material deals with your body, your hands, your feet, your flesh, right? Your chromosomes, your DNA, right? All the stuff you can touch. I guess DNA wouldn't count. That might be a little bit too hard to put your finger on. But it would still be material, as opposed to, say, the immaterial, which is soul, spirit, conscience, mind, will, right? The Bible talks about these things. And together, the material and the immaterial make up the whole man. Now, when we read the Bible, we can see the description of the creation of man. We see things like God created man in his own image. That's not said about anything else beside man. It's not talked about, the angels aren't talked about in that way, not the trees, not the animals. We're also told, subdue the earth, rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over everything that moves on the earth. So one ontological facet of man that we can discuss is his superiority over nature. Often we'll have political theories that try to diminish this, but God designed us as a special creation over nature. Now, regarding the facets of man, the material and the immaterial, we know that there is inherently a relationship between the two. James said that this body with the body without the spirit is dead, so there's a necessity for the two to be joined somehow to function. I think we can also derive that there's something of a middle ground, right? For example, the material aspect of man has lips, tongue, teeth, jaws, cheeks, and the immaterial has mind, will, and the image of God. So we could describe sort of a middle ground that necessitates both in terms of, for example, the capacity of language, which happens to come from God himself. Going back to Genesis 1, we see God speaking. In fact, the term God said occurs 10 times in Genesis 1, 8 of those times before he has a man to speak to. This would imply that language has its origin with God. It's not something that we developed as we evolved over the course of 11 bazillion years, as we started babbling, and then eventually coming to coherent speech. No, this is from God. So the capacity of language is something that is part of our design. I think that we could see this as a part of the divine institution of the individual. And this happens to be under attack, for example, by the concept of postmodern hermeneutics, which says that it's not the person speaking who creates the meaning of an idea that is to be received by the reader or listener. Rather, it's the receiver who is supposed to decide what that means to him. This is particularly a dangerous hermeneutics whenever it's applied to the Bible. We can see such doctrines as being an attack directly on our design as humans. Does that kind of make sense? Here's another one. So we have physical traits and self-awareness. Physical traits can include sexual reproductive organs, as well as secondary sexual organs, as well as chromosomes. That is to say, your biological sex. That combined with your self-awareness is your gender identity. What does the Bible say about gender identity? Well, we can go back to our creation narrative, and it says that male and female, God created humans. So it would be appropriate then for our gender identity to align with the physical traits which are part of God's design. However, this is currently under attack today through such movements as critical gender theory, which try to encourage people to abandon the male-female distinction which God has set up. Okay, so that's the discussion on ontology, and we can go further and further and further down that rabbit hole, but I'm supposed to shut up at 10:15, so we're going to move forward. Another aspect of anthropology and the divine institution of the individual deals with meta-ethics, specifically responsible labor. What am I talking about? Well, if we go back to Genesis chapter 2, we see that God put man in the Garden of Eden. Why? To tend and to keep it. He also gave him instructions, do not eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. So what are we seeing here? We're seeing the idea of labor, of work, being a holy thing, something that God has instituted for man. We see here that it's a good thing. We also see responsibility, right? When you eat of it, you will suffer the consequences, not someone else. And indeed, that's how it worked out. Adam disobeyed, and as a result, both thorns and thistles shall grow for you, and you will eat the plants of the field by the sweat of your face, you will eat bread. So labor is difficult because of sin, but it's still holy. It's something that God has instituted. So we can develop a meta-ethics of responsible labor that understands that we humans are supposed to be working. Okay, so that's how we can develop the divine institution of the individual in terms of the systematic theology doctrine of anthropology. Now, let's move on. The family. It is often said that the family is the fabric of society. I kind of like that. If that's the case, then maybe we could say that the individual is the thread of society. The family is described in the Bible. We see it with the first marriage in Genesis 2, 21 through 25, a key passage for this discussion. Are you able to hear me with this, by the way? Okay, I can, got a little wiggly here. Okay, we functioning? Okay, good. I'm getting a thumbs up in the back row, so that's, let's see, where were we? Oh, yes, the Bible. Genesis 2:24 says, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." So just like the divine institution of the individual has multiple facets, the family, I think we can derive two facets. One being the marital relationship, and the other being the parental relationship. So as we saw there, this verse 2:24 is kind of a key verse. The way it works, you have a man and a woman. They are designated as husband and wife to the exclusion of all others. And part of this union is the production of children, which is optional, but certainly commanded in the beginning, the Genesis account. We know from the writings of the Apostle Paul that it's fine not to get married, but there are certain married behaviors that should stay only within marriage. Okay, so mother and father have kids. They grow up. They're still in the same family unit. Meanwhile, there can be another family unit adjacent. And when one male from one and a female from the other become husband and wife, this begins a new family unit. This does not negate the fact that the wife is still the daughter of the parents, and so is the husband. Mark chapter 7 has some really interesting things to say about that. However, even though we are to continue honoring our parents for the duration of our lives, this is now a new family unit. And then the children that are born into this family unit are part of that, and so forth. The divine institution of the family has unfortunately been marred by sin. And we are seeing some attacks on marriage that are particularly common here in the West. The first is to attempt to redefine the marital union such that it's not only available to a man and a woman, but so that it can be a man and a man or a woman and a woman. It's becoming a little extra sneaky these days because of the gender identity issue that we alluded to earlier. It has become acceptable practice for a man to pretend to be a woman or a woman to pretend to be a man. But if you have a trans man and a biological man married, a trans woman and another biological man married, that would not qualify as a proper marriage because that is two men, not a man and a woman. By the same account, polygamy would be disqualified, I think, because what happens? You have a man and a woman, so they get married, they become one flesh. Bring in another woman, and now you have one woman becoming one flesh with another woman, right? So I think that would by default be disqualified as well. Another issue that we are seeing is the blurring of the distinction between a single man and a single woman and a married man and woman. It has become the common practice in America today for a man and a woman to choose to live together for a period and behave as if they are married, perhaps even having kids, before finally sitting down and saying, okay, we are going to commit ourselves to each other to the exclusion of all others. This is inherently a sinful arrangement because it involves sexual relationships outside of marriage. Now, we've just looked at a series of inherently sinful relationships. This is where pastoral wisdom comes into play, because this is the way of our society, and if you happen to be engaged in an arrangement that looks like one of these, I would encourage you to get out of it. So we're faced with a difficult question of how do we deal with such arrangements in society, and it's been interesting talking to pastors that have had homosexual pairs come to realize that they're doing the wrong thing and start trying to pursue a right way forward, or having unmarried couples come in and move toward marriage. It's a difficult question. I'm not pretending it's not. But I think we can define the boundaries of the family from the Bible, even if there are challenges coming from the world. Okay, so we talked about the individual and we've talked about the family. Next, we'll talk about the country. To understand the country as a divine institution, we need to understand two important events from the Genesis 1 through 11 narrative. The first is the giving of the Noahic covenant, which we see in Genesis 8:20 through 9:17. There's some fun discussion as to whether or not the end of Genesis 8 would qualify as the Noahic covenant or not. And the other is the global dispersion that happens in Genesis 11:1 through 9. So, the Noahic covenant. If you'll recall, we begin human history in the Garden of Eden. There's no sin. And the instructions are pretty simple. Don't eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, tend the garden, and so forth. We mess that up. They eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. What did they have after they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? They had the knowledge of good and evil. That is to say, they have a conscience. As soon as they ate, what's the first thing they realized? That they were naked. And they tried to clothe themselves using fig trees, fig leaves. So this knowledge of good and evil, or conscience, becomes the guiding principle throughout the next dispensation. Just follow your heart. Do what you feel is right. Don't do what you feel is wrong. Does that sound familiar, by the way? Sound kind of like what we're hearing today? Okay. Did it work out? No. It led to global debauchery, hence the need for a global flood. This is one reason I am very concerned about the tendency for people to say, oh, I'll just do what's right in my eyes. It didn't work then. It didn't work in Judges. Don't try it now. So, instead of everybody doing what's right in his own eyes, after the flood, God gave the Noahic covenant, in which he has this bit in the yellow. Surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I will require it, and from the hand of man. From the hand of every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. This is the foundation for civil government. Now instead of man doing whatever's right in his own eyes, he has other men to be accountable to. This would indicate a necessity for some sort of system to ensure that they're actually executing the right guy, hence civil government and the courts of justice. By the way, it's also interesting that the reason is given here. For in the image of God, he made man. It goes back to ontology, right? The nature of man himself being in God's image. Okay, so from this we get the idea of a civil government. Moving on a little bit, God told man to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, and man said, nope, come, let us build ourselves a city and make a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. Complete rebellion against God here. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the earth. The Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. So what was the command? Fill the earth. What was the rebellion? It was to stay in one place and have sort of a global community. Globalism is something we should be worried about from the biblical implication here. All right. There is a passage in Deuteronomy that gives us some interesting commentary on what we've just read. Deuteronomy 32 has the Song of Moses, if you'll remember, at the end of the Torah, Moses giving us kind of the last little bit. And in 32:8, he says, when the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam. This is a very clear reference back to the Tower of Babel, unless you can think of another global dispersion that God carried out. No, this is Babel. And it says, he set the boundaries of the people. So this is where the creation science starts to get interesting. Moses is describing here boundaries that God has set up in order to keep the people separate. So there's an interesting discussion, for example, whenever we look at the Himalayas and the Washita Mountains. The Himalayas are all pointy and jaggedy, and they look like Mount Crumpet, where the Grinch would take up residence and look down hating the Whos, whereas the Washita Mountains are kind of smooth, right? Now, our secular friends would like to tell us that the reason is that the Washita Mountains are very old, 300 to 350 million years old, while the Himalayas are relatively young, 50 million years old. The Himalayas just haven't had time to get smoothed out over the course of erosion. I might agree that the Himalayas are actually younger than the Washita, but I think they got their math wrong. Could it be instead that the Washita Mountains were formed during the flood, under the floodwaters, whereas the Himalayas could be a post-flood convention? There's a big debate going on amongst creationists about where the flood, post-flood boundary is. In other words, the flood was all over the whole world, and if we look at the layers of rock that the geologists have discovered, which layer of rock was the last one to be laid down by the flood? And then whenever the waters receded, what did they cut through? And then which rock layers have been added since then? If we hold to the KPG boundary, which is one that a lot of us hold to, not everybody does, then everything that's above the KPG boundary is post-flood, and that would include mountains like the Himalayas, which would mean they crashed together and God used tectonic plates, movement, and whatnot to form that. Okay, so it could be that the reason that we have certain mountain ranges that are higher up in the geological record, it could be that God put these mountains here as part of what we saw in Deuteronomy 32:8, in order to form natural boundaries between the people. That's one way that God could have done it. He could have used multiple ways, and I think that could be one. Another thing is the potential for an ice age to have been occurring after the flood and as a result of the flood. So today, what's all the hype? We're worried about global warming, right? What's going to happen if we have global warming? The ice caps are going to melt, and then the water levels are going to rise, and then that's going to flood our cities on the coast. Between you and me, I'm looking at some of those cities thinking maybe they need to be flooded out a little bit. But I'll let that go. Okay, so if less ice means more water and less land, wouldn't the opposite also kind of be true? More ice, as in the ice age, would mean that the water levels would go down, which would mean that there would be more land. As a result, this is a map that was formulated by Answers in Genesis, but following this kind of model, we could see that there could be more land bridges between Asia and America, for example, as well as ice bridges that could be moved across. So it could be that whenever we see boundaries being set, it could be that God had the ice age, he separated the man, and then once men separated, he ended the ice age, bringing up the water to separate the man and to put boundaries between men that way. I don't think this would be outside of what we've seen God do before. There has been some interesting evidence presented in some secular journals about the potential for climate to have been a factor in the rise and fall of the Neo-Assyrian Empire, which, if you think back to the Bible, the Neo-Assyrian Empire is that empire that rose around the same time as the Neo-Babylonian Empire, and God used this to chastise his beloved Israel. Could it be that God, who is able to control the climate, used the climate in order to carry out his purposes there? I think so, and I think it could be that God used the collapse of the ice age to separate the peoples and to have natural boundaries between us. Of course, the continual change to the landscape continues to change more slowly today than the more catastrophic past, but we continue to see rivers changing course throughout history. I have a friend who was, his family was from South Texas, and he appeared to be Hispanic, and people would poke fun at him with the typical somewhat racially charged insult. Oh, you're a border jumper, right? You came over to Texas from Mexico. And he said, no, actually, it's not that my family jumped over the border. It's that the border jumped over us. That is to say, they lived next to the Rio Grande River just on the south side. And then one day, the Rio Grande shifted and they woke up and now they're in Texas. So we do see a natural bend of these sort of boundaries shifting. If you look at a map today of the world, you will notice that the lines between the countries tend to be more squiggly than straight, to use the technical terminology. This is because we are naturally turning to features like rivers as boundaries. We do have straight lines sometimes, especially whenever there's a large expanse. But I think that God has designed the planet to be like this so that we can have distinct territories for the defense of the people. Returning to Deuteronomy 32:8, the last little bit of the verse has this interesting line. He said that he set the boundaries of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Now there's a textual variant here. The Masoretic text, the Hebrew, has what we've just read, according to the number of the children of Israel. Children of Israel being Bnei Yisrael in the Hebrew. However, the Septuagint has according to the number of the angels of God, and there's a Qumran text, which has according to the numbers of the sons of God. Following this reasoning, it would seem that God set up the borders according to perhaps the demonic influence in the world. We see this in Daniel 10 with the Prince of Persia and so forth. I think this is a doctrine that we can support biblically. However, I don't think that this is the proper textual variant. I would tend to lean toward the Masoretic text, the children of Israel. For one thing, the Greek text of Deuteronomy 32:8 is not set in stone as being the non-Masoretic reading. There are Septuagint texts that would have according to the sons of Israel, just like the Masoretic. What's more, the Samaritan Pentateuch, which is a text that will often sort of be bent as a propaganda against Israel, but even the Samaritan Pentateuch accepts that this is according to the numbers of the children of Israel. So I think that's the proper textual variant. Textual criticism aside, what is the significance of God setting these boundaries according to the numbers of the children of Israel? Well, I think that goes back to the Abrahamic covenant. Of course, the dispersion took place right before this, but God knew about this before he dispersed them. But God told Abraham, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So what's the implication here geopolitically? It seems that God has set up these boundaries, physical boundaries, so that the countries may be distinct from each other. Yet he did so in a way such that Israel and members of Israel could still traverse and get around. Being as how Israel is a light to the nations, it would seem fitting that God wouldn't want to isolate people from Israel entirely. So it's still possible to get around. Now, just because you have a river here doesn't mean the river can't be crossed, right? If you're trying to cross over in peace to bring the good news, it can be done. However, if you're crossing and trying to pillage and so forth, it's a lot easier to pick off the bad guys whenever they're in a spot like a river. Little military science 101 for you. Okay, so pulling all this together, pulling from the Noahic covenant and the dispersion at Babylon and what we saw in Deuteronomy 32:8, I think we can derive three facets of a country, just like the other two have facets as well. The three facets of a country, I think, are a distinct territory with a civil government to protect the people in the land. Right? The distinct territory where you can derive, I think, from what we saw in Deuteronomy 32:8, as well as other biblical commentary on the nature of nations. Civil government we're getting from the Abrahamic covenant, and it is in the Noahic covenant that we see that it is for, to protect the people in the land. The reason for the protection of the people in the land is that man is created in God's image. So even if we have multiple people groups within the distinct territory, the civil government is still there for their protection. It doesn't matter if your skin happens to absorb more light, whereas his skin happens to reflect more light. That's a rather superficial difference that people make a lot of a deal over. The civil government is still there to protect everyone in the land. Okie dokie. So, quick review. The three divine institutions are the individual, the family, and the country. I'm setting these apart because these are social structures which God has designed so that we are, by default, a member of all three by default. Of course, there are extreme situations. What if you're fatherless and your mother dies in childbirth? Okay, you can be born without a family, right? What if you're born at sea as a stateless pirate? Okay, you can be without a country. But these are what God has designed us to be a part of by default. All right, so we've looked at how worldviews work. We looked at some alternative models. We took a look at the divine institution models. In the next hour, we are going to look at some political ideologies that are bent against God's design for the divine institutions. We're going to look at the doctrinal considerations, a review of what we just did. And then we're going to look at some historical development of political thought through the 20th century that have led up to today, where we are currently seeing the left woke crowd and the Russian fascist crowd both trying to attack the divine institutions. Then we will use the divine institutions to evaluate these post-fascist thoughts. Okay, I'm done.